You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at freestylelibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit myfreestyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, for prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.
The Market Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell.
Let me hit record. Yep. A bit of music there.
Hello and welcome to the Market Musings Podcast, where today our guest is Ben Turney, the CEO of Govango Resources. Ben, it's the first time that you've been on the Market Musings podcast. I know me and you speak quite a lot on the interview, but it's great to have you on this podcast. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, it's good to hear from you. So, and of course, Kenny as well joining us. How are you, Kenny?
Yep, all good. Great to have you on, Ben. And I'm delighted to say it's bright blue sky in Scotland. So, yeah, all is well in the world.
Well, it's miserable down here for once. We've had lovely weather recently.
Oh, well, good. But as Mark says, Ben, you know, this is podcast number 168. What's kept you?
Good question. Been a bit busy. I mean, as you said before we started, you know, they nailed down Osama bin Laden quicker than they managed to get me on this podcast.
Yeah, we have been trying for a while, but there's been bits and pieces in both sides. It's just pushed it back a few weeks, if not months. So, but no, it's great to have you on. And I know from personal experience you've got an interesting background. So, really, what we like to do in this podcast, Ben, is you know, people invest in people. I mean, you can have the best assets in the world in a company, but if you've got terrible management, then nothing's going to work. So people like to know about the person that's, you know, that's controlling the company in the background. So really, it's an opportunity for you, Ben, to give us a bit of a potted history of Ben Turney. You know, you can go back as far as you want. You know, early school, childhood, where you were born, education, you know, what you done when you left school, and then ultimately your journey to Govango Resources and all the successes and failures, because we've all had failures. Well, I've certainly had plenty, and I learn more from failures than I do successes. So really, the floor is yours for the next 10-15 minutes, Ben.
All right, well, thanks. I'd probably best to start when I was at university. So I figured out sort of very early in my life that I was pretty much unemployable. I knew that I'd never sort of follow a traditional career. I'm a very sort of headstrong person. I always have been. I've liked to sort of, you know, follow my own path, carve my own path. And that's obviously, you know, that's made life very difficult at times. You know, I spent a lot of my 20s, I had my first business when I was at university. And so I spent a lot of my 20s doing a lot of sort of entrepreneurial stuff. I had a web design agency that was actually pretty successful in Manchester. And from there, I set up a startup investment company. It was almost like a precursor to crowdfunding, but at the time I didn't realize what I'd built. This was in about 2005, 2006 when I started that. So I was sort of mid late 20s, 26, 27. And I ran a venture centre in a partnership with the University of Manchester. It had some grant funding that was attached to it. We had about £2 million worth of funding that sort of got that business off the ground. We had our first investment. You know, it was all really starting to go quite well. And what we were trying to pioneer was a funding model for small startup companies coming out of the university, sort of mainly run by sort of students or ex-students. We're sort of trying to provide them with access to capital to get their businesses off the ground. And we had some, you know, great opportunities that we worked with. And we were on the cusp of selling our first investment to a major national chain of home. Well, I'll say actually, it doesn't matter. I'm not under confidentiality anymore. It was actually B&Q. So we were on the verge of selling a software product to B&Q. And I remember we went down on the 8th of August, 2008. It's a day I'll never forget because at the time, we got authorization from the FSA. So we found out that our funding model was about to be approved because we were going through an application process with them. And we also went down to Southampton, down to B&Q's headquarters to meet with one of their directors, sign a heads of terms, ready to sell our software product. But as I'm sure you'll both remember, 8th of August 2008, that was 1 month before Lehman Brothers failed. So, you know, that was a bit of a sort of a peak in my career at that time. Then obviously a month later, the entire world fell apart. You know, the financial crisis was already happening. You'd seen Bear Stearns had collapsed that summer. But, you know, things were just about limping along. But of course, when Lehman Brothers went under that September, everything went to hell very, very quickly. And unfortunately, you know, the deal that we had fell off the table. You know, we were no longer able to complete on that. And over the next 12 months, I've got to be honest, I went through sort of probably what was the toughest period of my life as my business sort of, you know, initially gradually, but then sort of increasingly started to fall apart. I had 12 employees at the start of all of that, and gradually, you know, had to sort of let people go. And then by the end of 2009, you know, the whole thing just completely crashed. And it was a pretty devastating experience, I'll be honest. And, but at the same time, like you say, Kenny, it was formative, you know, what I learned during that period, you know, just about myself more than anything, but just, you know, sort of basic, you know, survival skills, was experience that's really stood me in great stead for the rest of my life. I mean, I was brought up to be a very resilient person. My mum is, I think the only way to describe my mum is she's a warrior. You know, she raised me and my sister to be sort of very strong and independent people. And that was a time in my life that was a real test. And sort of after that, I had the wreckage of my business. I mean, I know a load of nonsense has been written about me online. We'll talk a bit about sort of what I've done in the markets over the years. But I didn't go bankrupt. I came bloody close to it, I can tell you. But I managed to negotiate directly with my creditors. I mean, one of the sort of silver linings of the financial crisis was because, of course, the financial system was in such turmoil. The banks were pretty much accepting any sort of offers at that time to get some liquidity in. So I had the business's debts were in my name. I had personal guarantees against those. And it was, they're pretty brutal. I mean, that's something I'd never, ever do again. Like, personal guarantees are a vicious mechanism. But I was able to negotiate with the banks, and they accepted 15 pence in the pound in a directly negotiated settlement. And then for the next couple of years, I just worked my way out of it. Had some interesting experiences over those next couple of years. Moved to Sweden, moved back to England, ended up living with a group of nuns for 12 months. I helped build a monastery in Nottinghamshire, which was a fantastic period. Wow. of both healing and sort of, yeah, contemplation and sort of, you know, getting myself back together before I moved into the next phase of my life. I then moved back to Sweden permanently. I met a woman over there, fantastic woman. We had a great relationship for about 8 years. We have two, you know, beautiful daughters together. And that period of my career, that was when I started to get into the markets. So I was brought into the markets originally by Paul Johnson, actually. I'd known Paul from my time in Manchester. So Paul's brother, David, back in the day, was a business mentor to me in my early 20s. And then he was sort of loosely involved in my company, the startup investment company I had. So I've known the family for quite a long time. And I was at a bit of a loose end when I first moved over to Sweden. And one of the things that I'd done sort of while my business was sort of unwinding, I'd started blogging, just writing about financial markets. I've always been very interested in markets. I've always been actively involved. I bought my first stocks when I was 18. That was at the tail end of the dot-com boom. And I just had started writing as a bit of a release. And turns out I've got a bit of a talent for it. I mean, I hadn't realized, you know, that this was a skill of mine. It's one that I developed. Paul at the time had set Mining Maven up. This is when Mining Maven first began. And he asked me through David if I could write for them. So that was my introductions into this market. I think I came in sort of fairly naive at the beginning. Sort of I was looking at believing I was a capitalist and that markets were wonderful and that, you know, these are the way forward and, you know, these are forces for good for humanity with all the great things that markets can do. And obviously very, very quickly learned sort of the darker side of AIM in particular and the small cap world. You know, we know that this is quite a dangerous environment a lot of the time, but it's also an amazing environment as well. I mean, there is so much opportunity. It's an environment that rewards performance. It rewards talent. And if you stick with it, and if you're determined enough, you can make life-changing amounts of money. And so over the last 10 years, I think developed my market skills. I've done a number of different things in the market, which I suppose we could talk about in a minute. But that pretty much takes me up to my early 30s. And I guess maybe sort of hand over to you and sort of maybe we could start talking about the market side of things.
Mm. Well, yeah, I didn't know any of that, Ben. Yeah, that's quite interesting. I knew you went to Sweden for a bit, but that's about all I knew. Your business that nearly went bust, what was that about?
So it was a startup investment company. It was called VenturePoint.
Yeah.
And it was a private business. It was mine. But we had a partnership with the University of Manchester. At the time, there was a major redevelopment in East Manchester. They'd set up a new science park. And there was a 4,500 square foot venture center that had been fully kitted out with, I think it was 26 desks. It was like a big open plan office, you know, modern equipment. And the university itself, you know, they were a bit of a loose end loss to decide, you know, what they were going to do with this thing. And I was approached to see what ideas I would have for running a program there. So I put a proposal together and we started to build this model to finance startup companies. It's obviously long been known that one of the big financing gaps in the business world is that sort of that startup phase. It's the most difficult area to raise money for. This was obviously before crowdfunding, so before you know, sites like Seeders and what have you set up, which are obviously looking to address exactly the same market. But unfortunately, the timing on it was wrong.
Yeah.
The financial crisis was horrific, as we all know, and that really did sort of, you know, kill that business dead in its tracks.
Yeah. Well, there's nothing you can do about timing, is there? That's out of your control.
You need luck. Everyone needs luck. I mean, you can work as hard as you can. You can be as talented as you like. But ultimately, you know, everybody does need that little bit of luck to get themselves over the line.
Yeah. I mean, ask any successful businessman. There's always been a right place, right time moment that's just been the catalyst, you know, for the growth. It's I don't think there's anyone that's not had a bit of luck somewhere along the line, bumping into the right person.
Yeah. Absolutely. And just picking up on something you said at the start, Kenny, I think that's absolutely right. But you also, what you need is you can't have a fear of failure. You have to be prepared to give something a go, you know, put everything into it, put your heart into it and accept that some things just don't work out. And if it doesn't work out, you pick yourself back up, you dust yourself off and you move on to the next thing. And I think that kind of resilience is also a very common characteristic. You know, we as a society, we like to look at people's successes. People very much will focus on the success story, you know, such and such has made so much by, you know, the age of 40 or 50, whatever it might be. But, you know, what's gone on before that? What experience? What's the foundation that enabled them that when they had that opportunity that came that way, how could they spot it? How could they seize it? And more importantly, how could they actually do something with it?
Yeah, I think it was quite interesting. This is a bit of a fishbone off the main path. I mean, we're talking about failures. You know, there's a difference between Scottish and English mentality. So if Scotland fail at anything, it's a glorious failure. But if England fail at anything, it seems to be punished. So it does. It's really bizarre. We're almost the same people, but there's a border between us, and it's just a different perspective in life. I don't know if it's bloody colder up here. Maybe that's what it is. I don't know. But it's weird how, you know, how we're all on the same island, but it's just different attitudes towards failures.
It's an interesting observation, and I completely agree with what you're saying. I mean, one of my closest business partners is up in Glasgow, you know, not far from you, as you know. I've done a lot of work with him over the last 3 years, and it's exactly the same. I mean, his attitude is very, very different to a lot of what you experience down here in England. you know, there is sort of failure in England. It really is still a bit of a taboo. You know, people like to throw it at you as if it's some sort of insult or, you know, some sort of mark against your character. But it's those failures. And I think particularly the ability to come back from a failure that I think, as far as I'm concerned, really marks an entrepreneur.
Indeed. Definitely. Yeah. Do you think, I mean, would you say you still have that entrepreneurial spirit? And what is it like? It must have felt terrible when your business was going to the wall and you had these personal guarantees. I mean, and a few people would have probably experienced that. What does it feel like, and how on earth do you come back from that?
I honestly wouldn't wish it on anybody, because it leaves you sort of, you question everything about yourself, your whole worldview, you know, takes one hell of a kicking. It's difficult to describe what it feels like. I mean, it's a combination of things, isn't it? I suppose, you know, you have sort of, there's dread, there's fear, there's worry for the future, sense of letting people down. I think it's as with any negative feeling, you just, if I'm really honest, you've just got to be a bit kind to yourself. You've got to be a bit kind to yourself, literally pick yourself back up, make yourself stand back up and just start to move on. And yeah, it's going to sound a bit trite, take each day as it comes. And slowly but surely, you'll move into a sort of a better situation. I mean, one thing I do remember is that there was sort of a phrase that I'd heard before about hitting rock bottom. The interesting thing about hitting rock bottom is, from my experience, is you actually know when you've hit it, because at that point it's almost like there's a turn in the air, sort of a change in the wind, and you can just feel actually everything is now starting to get better. And then that gradually starts to take a momentum of its own, and you know, and then things obviously improve. I mean, I went from sort of, you know, pursuing a career where I was very focused on money. I mean, I really wanted to, you know, just make lots of money, and that was my primary focus. But then I ended up meeting, you know, an amazing woman, and we had a great relationship together. But also, you know, this experience of living with the nuns in their new monastery that I helped build, and you know, that was just a very, very different experience. And you know, taught me sort of more about, you know, what else is in life. There is a lot more out there.
What took you there? Was it just this lady?
Love, Mark.
Right, love. Love took you there. Okay.
I don't get Mark started in love. I think we should move on to the financial markets.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, this is probably a good idea. Yeah. So you discovered a hidden talent for writing then, and then you spent a bit of time working for Mining Maven, doing sort of freelance sort of analysis write-ups on stocks. Is that right?
Yeah, so it was sort of paid-for analysis on stocks. Yeah, it was sort of my first introduction to small cap space. I did that for about 18 months, a couple of years. But from there, I sort of started doing a bit more investigative stuff. I got a bit sort of drawn more to the dark side of this market. And through just a series of events, ended up working for Share Profits. I ended up being editor there. Bit of an off and on relationship, but you know, overall was fine. It was certainly an interesting experience. I learned one hell of a lot about the way markets work working for that website. And I think that, you know, a lot of retail investors, I don't think they really sort of, you know, see just quite what happens behind the scenes in this marketplace, and just quite how careful you have to be with your money. It is a pretty brutal environment. And while, you know, I'm sort of very passionate about markets, and I do believe in the positive potential of them, you do really have to be mindful of what else is happening out there. And remember, above all, that the market is designed to take your money away from you. And I think sort of a lot of people would do well to sort of learn that lesson and just behave a bit more cautiously in terms of, you know, how they manage their portfolios and manage their money. Because I mean, a lot of the stuff that I saw behind the scenes, I mean, I'm not going to go into details here, and I realize I'm sort of dangling a bit of a carrot, but, you know, there was so much stuff that we just couldn't report on because of, you know, for fear of the libel laws and the libel rules, you know, stuff that we damn well knew had happened. And sort of any sort of moral, sensible person, if you put it in front of them, you know, would be able to see what had happened, but, you know, how that would then be viewed by you know, law courts and a libel trial, because you haven't got the definitive proof. And I mean, there really is a lot of very shady stuff that happens in this market. And I found myself doing that for a few years. And then from that, I moved into shareholder activism. You know, I still think I was very much in a bit of a righteous phase in my life, you know, saw the wrongs that were happening, you know, was pretty disgusted by a lot of what I'd seen, and, you know, wanted to help try and change the market. You know, there you go. There was a great, noble, lofty ambition. And of course, it was a total waste of my time. Just being completely honest, you know, the market is what the market is. And we all ultimately just have to make out of it what we can. But the activism work I did, you know, had some big wins on it. took some big losses as well. So it was a mixed bag, but it did teach me a lot about sort of how the market itself actually functions. Mm. So I did a lot of work on, you know, shorting and naked shorting, really understood the mechanics of that, that, you know, the actors as well, you know, the people involved in it and sort of quite how pervasive it is. And that was extremely valuable experience. But then over the last few years, I've moved much more, you know, back to my original roots, more to the entrepreneurial side, you know, looking to have more of a positive impact on businesses, you know, directly and individually, just by trying to do things the right way. And obviously that brings me to today and the role I'm doing in Kavango.
Well, just on the activism there, Ben, when you had this righteous phase in your life, you said it was a waste of time. Would you say it is a waste of time? Are the markets sort of crook and can they be fixed? Or is it more a case of just understand you're in this kind of crooked game and try not to do, or do your best to avoid, you know, being stung?
It's a big question, Mark. It's a question I've thought about a lot. I think they can be fixed. I think they can be saved, but maybe not in the way a lot of people expect. I think what it really comes down to is actually individual buying behavior. If individuals, you know, did their research better and understood more about the companies and stopped buying this crap that's out there, and I'm sorry to use that word, but most of it is. I mean, a lot of this small cap space, these are not proper companies. These are paper sales agents. You know, they're there to sell their stock to the market, and that really is it. They're not trying to build proper businesses. But while people keep on buying these stocks and, you know, they keep giving their money away to these people, and I will say this, there are a lot of crooks out there. Mm. You know, if people are going to keep giving their money to crooks, then, you know, they are providing, you know, fuel to the fire. So I think really the only way is for people to become, you know, more discerning themselves and better investors. And I know it might sound a little bit hard, but it's the only way that I can see, because the markets themselves, you know, they aren't going to reform themselves, because there's no incentive for anybody to do it. So I think it does actually come down to us as individual investors just to buy better.
Yeah, just playing devil's advocate, Ben. I mean, you can still make money out of crap stocks, to use your words. You know, I've invested in plenty of stuff that I'm not particularly keen on, but there's always an opportunity, so there is, and sometimes it's just playing the game. And
yeah, you're right, Kenny, you are. I mean, look, you're completely right, and look, I've done it myself as well, so, you know, I'm not gonna put myself up on a pedestal here and sound all high and mighty, because like you and I both know exactly how this game works. And if something has dropped, but you know there's a decent narrative behind it and it's likely to get a pump, and you can see yourself making, you know, a 50% return, you know, if it's, I mean, I try not to make those sorts of trades anymore. I mean, I'm obviously so busy with this role that I'm restricting myself, you know, much more to companies I really, really believe in. I mean, one of the guys I really like following on Twitter, just as an example, is that Ian Cassell. I think I've seen you retweeting his stuff. I think the advice that he gives out to retail investors, he's very, very positive, you know, very thoroughly researched. American guy, you know, really sort of nice air about him as well. And he's obviously been incredibly successful. So, you know, there's another investor out there who, you know, I don't know personally, but, you know, he goes by the name Barenday Investments or Barenday Trading, whatever his name is. So while you're right, Kenny, it is possible to make money out of that sort of junk. There are people who are also showing us that there's potentially a lot of money to be made by, you know, looking for decent companies.
Yeah, no, definitely agree there. All right, well, you've mentioned Kavango a few times as well, Ben. So, I mean, how did that come about? Because you've kind of come in from the cold, shall we say. You know, it's not as if you've had you started off as a Ned, obviously, Kavango, but there was no sort of experience before Kavango.
Well, actually, I didn't. I went straight in as an executive, and I pretty much took over the running of the company from the start. So, yeah, all right, well, let's go into the history of it. So April 2020, actually, I probably should go back to the IPO, shouldn't I? So I first met Mike Moles in January 2018 when they were first looking to do the Kavango IPO. It was meant to have happened in February that year. I invested quite heavily into it because, you know, I spent a long time on the phone with Mike. We had a long Zoom call. You know, he sold me his vision for the KSZ, which I really bought into. And, you know, my impression of Mike was that, you know, very honest guy. I didn't believe he was one of the sort of pump and dump merchants. I felt that this was a guy who was very serious about pursuing exploration in the Kalahari Suture Zone. And, you know, the story, the model itself, I like what I heard. They eventually got the company onto market that summer. the next sort of 18 months, they didn't exactly have the best time. I think one of their main problems was their communications. They had this epic story in the KSZ, genuine, you know, project that they were going for. Very high risk, of course, we all know that. But they hadn't really got the message across. You know, their announcements were too technical. They weren't really sort of explaining it in a way that people could understand. And I'd had actually sold out most of my position. I'd kept some of it, and I'd stayed in touch with the company over that time. You know, I helped them out on a couple of things. They made a mistake with one placing. They were warned about that. One of the big things in this market is you've got to be very careful about whom you accept money from, because as soon as you start taking in the wrong sort of money, you know, you paint a target on yourself. You've got to, you know, box clever here. And they didn't. And by, I think it was April 2020, their share price was down to about 0.8 pence, which was about 65% below the IPO price. And, you know, they were running on fumes. The company wasn't doing too well. So a bailout financing was put together, £400,000. And as part of that deal, I was asked to go in as a consultant to help with the IR side of things. So I started working directly for Covango. I was obviously doing it in the background. So I was on a retainer with them, just helping draft the RNSs, helping coordinate the investor relations message. And yeah, you know, it did well. It went from 0.8 pence in April that year. I think it peaked at around about 3.5 towards the end of the summer. And then by November, I bought a new broker in, First Equity. So I've known the guys over at First Equity for quite a long time. Brought them into the company, and we did a 2 million financing together at 2.75 pence, which was a cracking result for the company. You know, that was the most money the company had ever raised at that point. The chairman then stood down. So he moved on, went to pursue other interests, and they were looking for a new director. So I got a call at the end of November from Mike. I thought Mike was going to ask me if I had any candidates in mind. So I had a list of some people I was going to recommend and suggest. And he asked me if I'd like to join the board with a view to taking over from Michael as a CEO. Michael was obviously 70 at the time. You know, his health hasn't been great. You know, and you know, he's also earned his retirement as well. So they were thinking in terms of succession planning and someone to take over. I'd obviously worked closely with them since April. It had all been very successful together. We had a good working relationship. So they'd actually seen what I could do. You know, it was behind the scenes. And they wanted me to come in and take over as CEO. Now, again, I've got to be completely honest here. Mike took one hell of a gamble on me, bringing me in as this role. Obviously, I've not run a mining exploration company before. I've run companies before. I understand a lot about the markets. You know, I'd help get the company financed, you know, managed some fairly tricky issues behind the scenes that they needed to resolve on the corporate side. I'd help them through all of that. So you could see what I could do there. But in terms of the technical side of the business and the operational, you know, this was all completely new to me, and they did take, you know, a big risk. Now, when I came into Covango, the idea originally was that I'd become CEO in February. But it got a, I don't know sort of how much I should say it, but let's just talk openly. When I first came into the business, the operational side of the business needed a lot of love, and that's putting it quite kindly. There was a lot of improvements that were needed. There were things that just simply weren't working at that stage. And I think part of the problem, well, there are a number of problems really, is that to run a business like this, it's bloody hard work. I mean, there is so much that you have to do every day. You're running quite complex operations. There's a huge amount that you need to understand, sort of both technically, health and safety wise, sort of operationally, logistically. It's a very big job. And one of the things about Covango is the company's got a cracking portfolio of projects. But because it had been quite underfunded in the years leading up to me joining the company, that had meant that, you know, the investment that had been needed in terms of, you know, building the business, its infrastructure to a point where it could actually service those projects properly, it just hadn't really happened. So I was looking at this situation, and, you know, I realized that I'd got myself sort of one hell of a job on my hands here. So rather than immediately sort of leap in as CEO, what I'd said to the board is, look, let me just have 6 months in the company, get my hands on all the levers, start to make the improvements, see whether or not, you know, our working relationship will survive this, because, you know, we've, as part of this sort of process of reform and improvement, it's meant some, you know, pretty big changes, and changes in both attitudes and ways of doing things, which has meant there've been, you know, some pretty tough conversations along the way. I really have. But I want to just have 6 months sort of working sort of in a bit less of a high profile position as an executive director, just seeing what I could fix in the first instance and getting a much clearer view on what was needed for the business. Now, that first 6 months, I mean, that was hard going, really was last year. But, you know, I saw enough signs of improvements. I felt confident that, you know, I could actually make this work and I could take this role on and be successful at it. So I was then officially appointed as CEO, I think it was last June or July. I can't remember when we actually announced it, but that's when the move officially went through. Michael Foster obviously retired at the end of December. Mike's still on the board today, but we've now brought in Brett Grist. And the big thing about Brett is Brett is a fantastic person to work with. I mean, he's been in the company now since the start of February, so not been that long, but he's already had the transformational effect. And I think the one big area that Covango lacked was serious technical leadership. So someone at board level who was really going to come in and sort of take the ball by the horns and had the technical experience to drive a business like this forward. And now that we've got that on board, you know, we really are starting to motor and the business is looking in real sort of fighting fit shape. And I'm looking forward to what we're able to tell the market over the next few months.
Okay. Excellent. Yeah. Good. Well, that's paint a nice picture of how you got there, Ben. I wonder. I just wanted to go back to what you said earlier on, just about sort of a bad placing. What do you mean by that? When you have bad money in a company that causes problems that happened to Covango before you joined.
I wondered if I should bring this up. Sorry, let's do it. So in the market, the way that there are sort of certain market participants, the way that they make their money is through shorting. And I'm not one of these conspiracy theorists who, you know, likes to use, you know, shorts as the boogeyman, because this is something that, you know, I've learned a lot very specifically about how it works, how the various pump and dump operators work, you know, how so-called friendly market commentators, how they are basically in the pockets of shorts. And they know damn well they are, because they create liquidity events for short positions to build up, or for, you know, these sort of poor quality placings for this rubbish to be sold on to the retail public. But what happens if you start taking the wrong sort of money into these stocks? I think there's two aspects to it. First of all, it's to do with the shorts. If you ever let a short close out in a placing, you've just painted a target on yourself, because what you as a board of directors basically have sent the message out to the people who have been shorting your stock is that you'll let the shorts off the hook. Okay. And as soon as the shorts know that they can close out a placing, so they can close out a short position in a placing, then it stands to reason they'll short you again in future. Mm. And I'm afraid the way a lot of these companies are run, you know, they are basically there to pay fees, and the directors don't really care about shareholder value, and they will continue to, you know, take money at ever lower prices. But then the other money you've got to be very careful of is these sort of large blocks of stock that can build up. So they notionally will sit there as a block of stock, but then all sorts of like quite tricky and sort of complicated financial instruments can then be derived from those blocks of stock. Because once there's a block of stock that exists, it can sort of be lent out to enable shorting to happen, or all sorts of weird and wonderful things can happen with like various types of convertible instrument. And as soon as you start, you know, getting into bed with those sorts of finance providers, you're playing with fire, and, you know, those boys, they always win, and it's always at the expense of shareholders. So you've got to be very, very careful in this space about the type of money that you take in. Okay. If you take in just straight equity placings, you put warrants attached to those, you provide your company obviously with funds immediately to deliver on your plans, and then the warrant structures that are there are beneficial, because if you deliver on your operational plans and everything goes well with the business, you're providing the company with a very sort of clear pathway to finance. And that's a very, very important thing to understand about this business, is that you need to give your business the runway to perform.
Yeah. Okay. And of course, modest director fees as well, I guess, part of your ethos as well, Ben.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, this is on record. My basic salary with Covango is £90,000 a year. You know, there are some who say, oh, well, that's a lot of money. I really don't believe it is for the job that I'm doing. I mean, I'm one of the lower paid CEOs. I mean, I'm full time in this role. You know, this is basically a 6-7 day a week commitment. You know, I look at the sort of other salaries that are out there, you know, people paying themselves hundreds of thousands a year plus expenses, you know, plus, 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 plus. and they bleed these businesses dry, which is one of the main reasons that they don't really ever go anywhere, because there isn't any money to put into the ground. One of the things I've been most impressed about with Covango from the very beginning is that from a financial point of view, always have paid, you know, modest salaries, certainly compared to peers, but like the expenses regime here is negligible. It's you know, there's none of this sort of, you know, flying around business class or, you know, sort of other expenses that you know, you see creeping into other businesses.
Mm-hmm. Well, talking about putting money into the ground, let's talk about the project, shall we, Ben?
Yeah.
Which one shall we start with first? The one that's currently putting money in the ground, shall we?
Yeah, well, Ditto. Yeah. And he's putting money in the ground at the moment. Yeah, so we've moved into the Ditto drill campaign really quickly. We probably need to do a bit more to promote it. And it's been a tricky situation for us because we've obviously got news coming up on the KSZ. We had our proof of concept drill campaign that finished in February. Got a huge amount of data that we're working through on this, additional analysis that's been done. I mean, it's, and the new mineralization model that we're also looking at on top of, you know, what we believe is already there. So there's a great deal that's happening behind the scenes. The difficult spot we're in, obviously, with Covango is that, you know, if we start talking too much about Ditto at this stage, will the market then interpret that as, oh, well, you've then forgotten about the KSZ, when obviously the KSZ is absolutely still our primary focus. So I think what we're going to do is over the next few weeks, so there's news coming up. We're in the final stages on the various KSZ reports. I mean, that's in the public domain. You know, we've said that we're preparing those. I think once we've got those out of the way, we'll talk a lot more about Ditto. But the nature of the targets is pretty straightforward. We're looking for these carbonatites, as they're called, which are the source of rare earths. They're fairly easy to identify. We've managed to drill a water borehole in the area, so that's very important for drilling in the Ditto project because it is quite an arid region. And so far, it's, you know, all going to plan. You know, they're getting through the meters really nicely. It's a 6-hole campaign, so we think that will take us up until about the end of June to finish all 6 holes, and hopefully we'll be taking a step towards a discovery there.
Okay. Good. Just on the KSZ as well, then, Ben. I remember doing the interviews with you, and there was quite a lot of excitement, and we talked about it a lot. And what was going on there? Has it gone a little bit quiet there? It almost feels a slightly anti-climax, maybe. Were you sort of hoping for, I don't know, the glory hole? I don't know. What can you say about that? I don't like using
steady
that.
Mark. Steady. Yeah.
Easy there, Mark.
Yeah, there's a couple of innuendos in that sentence, I know.
Sorry. Okay. Yeah, well, all right. No, I mean, look, anticlimactic. I get it. I really do get it. Look, the thing is about metals exploration is it's not like oil and gas. It's not like where you sort of hit this massive gusher, and I'm probably hitting another innuendo there, sorry, which, yeah, you know, you can then immediately sort of start to commercialize. Metals exploration is just technically more challenging. Now, obviously, if you hit the mother lode at the start, then, you know, happy days. The main target that we were going for in the drill was, of course, the B1 conductor. But it then turned out that the B1 conductor wasn't a single conductor. There are several conductors down there. And this all comes down to the modelling. And I know people say, oh, well, you know, you're just making this up and this is just an excuse. But it really isn't the case, as we're going to show. I mean, we're doing very clear follow-up work on this. And unfortunately, that work just takes time. I'm not going to go off half-cocked in this business. You're going to see with this mineralization model that we talked about last year, you know, this has been knocking around now for 6 months. We've worked very, very hard on this. Most other companies would have rushed to publish what we'd identified last year. We've taken a more measured approach. Now, I know that in the short term is, you know, it can be a bit painful, especially in market conditions like this. And obviously our share price drop is front and center in a lot of people's minds, and I completely understand the frustration around this. All I would say is just bear with us a little bit, let us get our work done, and then, you know, when we present everything to the market, you'll clearly be able to see sort of why we've taken the decisions that we have, what work we've done, and then what the next steps forward are. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think that's really at this stage all I can say.
Well, just on that note, there's a phrase that I'm using more and more in my interviews now, which is show me, don't tell me. When do you think you might be able to show us? I know that's a very tough question to ask.
Oh, I hate this question, Mark. I hate it because everyone asks. I get it all the time on Twitter or on email. You know, look, I understand. I get it. And I'm afraid that the answer is what I say to everybody. We'll do it as soon as we possibly can. It is a lot of work. And, you know, I've fallen foul of this myself a bit, where I have overpromised a bit at times and people have asked me this question. I need just to rein it back in a bit. We've got substantial pieces of work that are in the final stages. I'm hoping, you know, we'll be able to start getting that news out in the nearest future. So we're talking sort of within sort of a few weeks would be my estimate at this stage.
Okay.
Can I just jump in, Mark? Obviously, we've not talked about The Sleeping Giant within Cavango, the one I think it's a dark horse. Obviously, you've got your Kalahari Copperbelt prospects sitting there quietly in the background.
Yeah, I mean, this all right, Kenny. So you're putting me on the spot there a bit. It's a cracking project. And yes, we've been a bit quiet about it. What can I say here? There's a lot of work that's going on the ground. And factually, what I can say is that 80% of our field teams are working in the Kalahari Copperbelt. So this is where we are putting a lot of our operational focus. The drilling and the TDEM surveys and the AMT surveys, those are all subcontractors. So those are not like our core team who's working on that. We've got a field team that's supporting all of those operationally, doing things like cutting lines, you know, providing other services, building the roads, overseeing the water borehole. But that's only one of our teams. All of our other teams are up on the Copperbelt. Now, as we know, the Copperbelt is an extremely hot province. We've got in total just over, well, getting on for 5,500 square kilometres across the two joint ventures. There are other opportunities there. Let's just put it that way. So at this stage, I understand, you know, people are asking, well, you know, what's going on with the Copperbelt? We're working through the ground as it stands, and we are aware of, you know, other potential there might be. So I think, you know, it's a cracking jurisdiction to work in. We've got some really interesting work that Brett is working on at the moment. So when Brett went over to Botswana, his primary focus was to go and look at the Copperbelt and come up with, you know, sort of the next stage of the action plan there, which he's done. And I hope that sort of, you know, we'll start to see a lot more sort of reporting from this project in the not too distant future, including plans for drilling as well. I know that there's a lot of pressure out there. People want us to get out there and drill the Copperbelt. We've got 5,500 square kilometres before we put the drill into the ground. This isn't like the Kalahari Suture Zone where it's proof of concept. When we go out drilling, you know, we're going to be going out looking for mineralisation. So, you know, we need to maximise our chances of success. And when we come to drill those targets, you know, just make sure that we've got, you know, the best, the highest priority targets that we can to drill.
Yeah, and there's definitely a lot of targets. I know that much from some of the media you've been putting out in the past. So, no, looking forward to that.
Yeah, we've ended up, you know, we've been quite fortunate in some ways. We've ended up with a really cracking portfolio of ground. The area sort of south and west of Guernsey, we believe, is underexplored. You know, there's more Kalahari cover there. So much more of the focus has been up in the northeast of the belt in Botswana. But if you jump over the other side of the border over to Namibia, you've got a huge amount of activity with, you know, mines in development and discoveries that have been made. And then you've got this massive blob in the middle, which is where we sit, which is basically in the western half of Botswana up to the Namibian border. And we've sewed up, you know, a large chunk of that ground. So we think it's a great opportunity for us. You've got mineralization in the northeast, you've got mineralization in the southwest. We believe it stands to reason that there's mineralization in the middle. So, you know, watch this space. Let's see.
Yep, you just took the words out of my mouth. I was just going to say, I'll watch this space. But excellent. All right, Mark, have you got anything to finish off with? Because I know we've been talking maybe 40, 45 minutes, so it seems an ideal time to wrap things up.
Yeah, I think we can wrap things up. The only thing I wanted to sort of ask you, but maybe you can have a few final words on it, is just one, as you were saying earlier about some of the not so great companies out there, the where people will end up ultimately getting hurt or getting fleeced, let's say. Have you got any kind of, from your shareholder activism and your editorial days, have you got any tips perhaps people could take for finding the good companies or splitting the good from the bad companies, like the pitfalls or the warning signs to look out for, just so people can perhaps be slightly better prepared when looking to put the money somewhere?
Yeah, well, there's a few things to look out for. Well, first of all, look out for the crowd. If you find that you're in a stock that's already a really crowded play, and this is just a general point, you've got to ask yourself, who's going to buy it off you? You know, if there are already loads of people talking about it, if it's already something that's, you know, featuring at the top of the bulletin boards, has got quite a lot of volume in it, you need to ask yourself, well, you know, where are the next buyers going to come from that's going to provide the next leg up? I mean, that's an easy thing to look out for. If you're really serious about your investing and you really are looking for decent companies to invest in, go and meet management, get in touch with them directly. You know, you can contact them on email, on Twitter, you can go watch presentations, you can go and meet them directly. Go and look these people, and they are mainly men. Go and look these men, you know, straight in the eye and just get a sense of whether or not you think this is somebody that you would trust with your money. I mean, it's a really simple thing to do, but I think there can be a lot of nervousness among investors to go out there and actually do this, but it's really, really worth sort of putting that effort in and going meeting these people. That's obviously not without risk, because some of these people are fantastic salespeople, but you need to go and meet management. And then finally, you need to, above all, just listen to what they say, but then watch what they do. So it's their actions that will always speak louder than their words. So if they meet their promises, great. If they don't meet their promises, they need to explain why they haven't done that. If you find there's a company that's saying it will do something, a particular type of project or whatever it might be, but then sort of quietly tries to sort of just walk away from that and, you know, get you to your focus and your attention on something else, that's normally a big red flag. But ultimately, the main thing is portfolio management. Never go in too hard on a stock. Always be able to walk away from a position. And I think if you have that as your basic sort of fundamental investing principle, that you'll never overinvest, you'll always be able to close out a position, then you shouldn't really go too wrong in this market. And believe me, this is a lesson that I've learned from very, very hard experience, where I have overcommitted, massively overcommitted. And yeah, it's just become an excruciating experience. So as long as you don't overcommit, you should generally be okay.
Okay, yeah, well, that's a good few words there of advice. Thank you, Ben. Thank you very much for that. So, look, it's been fascinating talking to you. I feel I've got to know you more in the last 40 minutes than the last 18 months we've been having chats on interviews, etc. So thank you very much for giving us your background there and what led you into Covango. And yeah, as Kenny says, we'll watch this space, particularly with the KSZ, the KCB, and of course Ditto as well, that's currently being drilled. And hopefully you can, your actions will speak louder than words, and we'll start to see some nice stuff coming out and get the picture a bit more clear. But I think that's...
Let's hope so, Mark. Otherwise, I'm going to be on here having to explain to you why we haven't delivered.
Indeed, yeah, and I'll ask you that, yeah.
Exactly.
Listen, Ben, thank you very much for your time. Kenny, are you good?
Yep, all good, all good. I can't think of anything else. No, I think we've covered everything. I mean, we could get you back on. No problem, Ben, but just don't wait another 168 podcasts for the next thing. I don't think I'll do another 168. That seems like a lifetime away, but you know, we're certainly churning these out at one or two a week, so you know, we'd soon get through them. But
it's a great show. Look, thanks for having me, and I hope I haven't bored on too much. You did give me a free mic, and I do like to talk, as you know, so hopefully it hasn't sort of meandered on too much for everybody.
No, I don't think so. And just a point, I'll just drop it in. We are at the UK Investor Show, and when you mentioned there about going, Ben, and meeting directors, meeting the CEOs, and talking to them face to face, these kind of shows are a good opportunity to do that. And I think so. That's the 21st of May in London, and yes, we're going to be there. Stockbox will be interviewing people from the floor, and you can get a free ticket, can't you, Kenny? What's our code? Stockbox22.
Yep,
it's our ticket code. Yes, if you go to the UK Investor Show, you can of course get a free ticket to that show, and hopefully we'll see many people there. But yeah, for now, thank you very much, Ben Turney, the CEO of Covango Resources.
Thanks very much, guys.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.